It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. I'm Gemma Gaudette, and you're listening to Idaho Matters. Today, our panel includes Margaret Carmel, reporter with BoiseDev.com, Harrison Berry, managing editor with the Boise Weekly, and Mike Sharp, executive producer with Idaho News 6. Hi, everybody.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
Hello.
Well, first, the big news of the day, which is, of course, that President Donald Trump and First Lady Melania Trump tested positive for the coronavirus. This comes just 3 days after the first presidential debate between Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden. And as this is a developing news story, make sure you stay tuned to this station for NPR news updates. We will talk about the politics of what this means in Idaho with the election just weeks away. But first, we wanted to check in with Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System, as well as a current member of the Governor's Coronavirus Task Force, and Dr. Sky Blue, an infectious disease doctor with Sawtooth Epidemiology. Thank you both for joining us today.
Hi, Gemma.
Hi there. Happy to be here.
Dr. Blue, I'd like to start with you. So we know that the president has questioned the use of masks and has been inconsistent in his own use of face coverings to protect against the virus. We know it's important to consistently wear masks when social distancing isn't possible. So we do know that he has been in close contact this week with White House staffer Hope Hicks. She tested positive and made that public yesterday. So I'm curious, from a tracing perspective, will we be able to learn definitively how the president contracted the virus?
Probably not. The timing of an exposure to the point that you test positive is variable. We know that the time from exposure to the onset of symptoms can be anywhere from 2 to 14 days, and on an average or the median is about 4 to 5 days. What is not known, and at least from what I've seen, is the frequency of testing that he has undergone and Hope Hicks or those around him has undergone, because that'll also help you know when somebody might have been infectious and in contact with him. So if we speculate, could there be a one individual who exposed both Hope Hicks and the president at some time prior? Or was it that Hope Hicks and the was the individual who exposed the president? Those give us two different timelines, and it could be informed by the number and type of negative test that he's had before this positive one.
And Dr. Pate, I want to talk about the potential of this being a spreader event. So, because here's what we know so far. The vice president has had a test. So far, he is negative. But we also know that Utah Senator Mike Lee was at the White House earlier this week. He has now tested positive for the virus. Senator Lee met Tuesday with Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett in his office. We also know that it's well documented that all higher level White House staffers don't wear masks around the president in the White House. So, with all of that information, could this be a super spreader event because of all of these factors and all of these people who are now testing positive?
Yeah, Gemma, I think first of all, we don't know when and where the president got infected. And unfortunately, with the level of activity of the president, I mean, if you just review what all has he done, where all has he been, and with what groups has he been with, it's a lot. And there's many possible avenues for where he could have been infected. Could it be a super spreader event that he was at? He certainly was in some indoor rooms with large numbers, 100, 150 people over the last week. We don't know about infections among those groups as to whether that might be it. On the other hand, it may just be that this is just transmitting from person to person who has been in close contact with the president or in that circle, and that's why we're seeing cases in a senator, cases in the president, his wife, the GOP committee chair, the Hope Hicks. So it's just not possible to say right now.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Blue, what is the difference between symptomatic and infectious? And when does that happen? And why does that matter? For other leaders, you know, these people within that close-knit circle.
Yeah, so infectious means that you have something that can transmit to another individual. And none of our tests really tell us that in particular. However, when you look at the literature and the studies that have actually tried to measure infectious virus and how they relate to the different tests that we use to look at that, we can draw some correlations and some speculation. So in general, what we know from that compilation of studies is that the date of symptom onset is probably the day that you're most infectious, that the viral level in nose and in upper airways is probably most transmittable. And in our contact tracing, in general, we look back 48 hours before that symptom onset, and there's good evidence to suggest that you could become infectious before that date of symptom onset. So it is different, however, if you're doing serial tests, because then you're actually picking up a time frame when the virus starts to become present. And depending on which test, whether it's the PCR, whether it's the antigen test, whether it's the Abbott ID Now type of nucleic acid test, measures different levels that correlate with different levels of virus. So if in general, if they have been doing one of the nucleic acid tests, and in fact, even probably the antigen test on a daily basis, then for usually around a day around the time of that test, it's pretty good evidence that an individual is not infectious unless there's really close contact, such as a spouse or a close family member. So then the day after symptom onset, for most individuals, the period of time where you actually have enough infectious virus to transmit, starts to drop off fairly rapidly. And that's where we get the data to say suggest that mild cases, 10 days, you are not likely going to have any infectious virus and unlikely to spread that. In more severe hospitalized cases or those with immunocompromise, that period of time where we can detect infectious virus is more variable. And in our current guidelines, we say may go out to around 20 days. And so those are the periods of time where we can find infectious virus, and depending on the transmission period, whether it's just casual contact, close household contact, healthcare contact, you may or may not be able to transmit during that period of time.
And then Dr. Pate, what are the president's risk factors, but also how long does it take for minor symptoms to potentially evolve into more serious symptoms? Because we know it's being reported right now that the president has minor symptoms, mild symptoms.
Right. Which is very interesting. Of course, as Dr. Blue said, we're not quite clear what the screening process has been at the White House. What we've previously been told is that the president gets tested every day and that anybody who's going to come into contact with him gets tested. I don't know if that was still occurring, but for the reasons that Dr. Blue just said, it is curious that he would just end up with a positive test last night if they were doing it every day, and he already has symptoms. Maybe they weren't doing the testing every day, or we were getting some false negatives. And I think an important point here is we can't test our way out of this pandemic. You still have to comply with all the precautions we've been talking about. But as to the president himself, of course, his biggest risk factor is his age. He's 74 years old, which puts him in the high risk group. And then, of course, we have seen an association of obesity or being overweight with worse outcomes. So those would probably be the two big risk factors for him.
And, you know, during this pandemic, we have heard President Trump promote treatments that are unfounded by science and are in fact not effective against coronavirus and present new dangers to patients, specifically hydroxychloroquine. Dr. Pate, are you concerned about this myth resurfacing during this time?
Oh, I am. And it already is, because the president made it quite clear that he was taking hydroxychloroquine in the past. We don't know what he's taking or if he's taking anything right now. There's not an approved or authorized treatment for somebody who is infected with COVID and has mild symptoms. We do have some other treatments, but they wouldn't be indicated. But I read the statement from President Trump's doctor, and he didn't mention if they were giving the president anything. And of course, given that they were willing, the White House doctor was willing to give him hydroxychloroquine at a time when it had not been studied or approved or authorized for prophylaxis, which is how he was taking it, one does wonder if they may be giving the president any other kinds of experimental or unproven treatments right now. They haven't made mention of whether they're giving him anything at all, so I don't know.
I do need to wrap this up, but I have two quick questions. Dr. Blue, even though we do know that Vice President Pence, we also know that that other people within that close circle, Ivanka Trump, Jared Kushner, have all tested negative, and that's what is being reported. Does that mean that they should not get tested again?
Yeah, so a lot of unknowns there, but if we speculate on a couple things, one is not knowing the rate of testing on the president. For most individuals, from the day of symptom onset, we work back 2 or 3 days. And if there was a significant exposure during that time, we would ask those individuals who were exposed to limit their exposure to others during the 14-day incubation period. That is not altered by a negative test at any point during that incubation period. However, during the time of around that negative test, there's a good chance that they are not infectious. But that would not say that the day after that negative test or 2 days from that negative test, they could be become infectious again. So one negative test will not say that they were not exposed. That would have to be done knowing their schedule, how close they were with the president, in which circumstances, indoor, outdoor, et cetera, whether he or they were wearing a mask and things of that nature. And just real quick, as you want to wrap it up, as what you were talking about before, as in these early symptoms, There's a couple things that we don't know that could shed some light on this. One is which test that they were using to confirm this, because we do know that a high viral load on that initial test, which is identified by a low CT threshold if they're doing a PCR, is associated with more severe clinical course. We also know that Dr. Pate suggested an early onset of symptoms after exposure is also associated with more severe illness. And as we're talking that viral illness, which is in the first 7 days, that's when those antiviral therapies, the remdesivir, convalescent plasma, monoclonal antibodies, interferon beta, those sort of therapies would be useful. They have not been studied in mild disease. However, their mechanism of action would suggest that the earlier that you give those and in the viral phase is when they will have their efficacy. So it'll be interesting to see in a situation where preventing progression to a more severe illness in a single individual is very important. So we'll wait to see. And as Dr. Pate pointed out, 7 days from symptom onset is when we start to get into the immune activation hyperinflammatory stage, when the more severe illness can arise. So that'll be a time frame we'll be watching from the symptom onset, which, you know, it sounds like may have some mild symptoms today. But if I was told I had a positive test, I might make a lot of the symptoms related at that point too.
And Dr. Pate, quick yes or no. If he'd been consistently wearing a mask, would do you believe that this could have been avoided?
I can't tell you just yes or no. It's possible. The most important thing, distance. Second most important thing, wear the mask.
All right. I appreciate both of you so much for coming on. We will, of course, continue this conversation with our Dr. Roundtable next Wednesday. And Dr. Pate, you will be participating in that. Thank you both, Dr. Blue and Dr. Pate.
Sure thing.
More with our report, and we'll have our reporter roundtable coming up next. Stick around. Now to our reporter roundtable with Margaret Carmel, reporter with BoiseDev.com, Harrison Berry, managing editor with the Boise Weekly, and Mike Sharp, executive producer with Idaho News 6. Margaret, I want to start with last night's debate between the candidates running for Ada County Highway District. If you could kind of get us updated on what happened.
Yeah, so this debate was Monday, and we're seeing a more competitive ACHD race than we've had in recent years. So there are three seats open and two candidates for each seat. Two of the candidates are incumbents, Commissioner Rebecca Arnold, who you might remember from the November 2019 mayoral race, and former state legislator Jim Hansen, Commissioner Jim Hansen. And then the other seat, seat five, all the other candidates are newcomers to political office. And really, what you heard consistently was a split over public transportation in lots of ways, and kind of this idea of whether or not ACHD should really be going to the mat to fund and support public transportation. You know, some of these candidates are like, I don't have an issue with public transit, but I don't think ACHD should be involved and we should focus on widening roads, building highways. And other candidates are, you know, much more supportive of, we really need, you know, to try to use this agency's weight to increase public transit infrastructure. So you're seeing, you know, candidates like Rebecca Arnold and, Dave McKinney, who's running for seat five, are very much coming down on the side of, we need to stay in our lane, so to speak, about building roads and highways. And then, you know, Jim Hansen and Emily Jackson Edney, the other candidate for seat five, are much more, you know, let's and Alexis Pickering, who's running against Rebecca Arnold, are much more aggressive about, let's go to the state legislature, let's try to get some laws changed so we can do more with transit. And so I think as transit is becoming a major issue, this race, you shouldn't sleep on this race, because it really could change policy out of that agency.
And that's an interesting point, Mark, because I would venture to say that, and fair enough to say, a lot of times these races like ACHD kind of go a bit unnoticed.
For sure. And, you know, it's easy to lose track of these kinds of things when you're busy and you have to pick up your kids from school and do laundry and cook dinner every night. It's so much easier to just get caught up in the presidential race. But really, these races like ACHD, that's going to affect things like whether you can take the bus to work, or you're going to be stuck with driving if that is the option, you know, that is the only option that you have, and how these funds are spent, whether, you know, that agency has historically kind of been much more fiscally conservative than other agencies in the Valley, in terms of not increasing property taxes, not increasing impact fees. And there's kind of, and that has come under fire in recent years, where folks have said, hey, why can't we keep up with all the road projects that we have? You know, that folks are looking and seeing the, you know, ever increasing congestion and frustration that there aren't more options for how to get around the Valley.
And I believe, Margaret, you listened in last night to a forum with the candidates running for Ada County Commissioner. And this forum was with Commissioner Diana Lociondo and her opponent, Ryan Davidson. And I believe you listened into that, correct?
Yes, I did. And one of the things that we're seeing in that race is, again, a really strong ideological split between, on two sides, coming down on one main issue, which is COVID-19. There were a lot of times in last night's debate where we saw agreement. You know, all four candidates were saying, hey, you know, we want to keep property tax burden down. I don't want to be forcing people from their homes because they can't pay property taxes. But the issue around COVID-19 was that major split. The Republicans, Rod Beck, former Idaho State Senator, and Ryan Davidson, were very much saying, let's get back to normal. You know, the government should not be telling people to wear a mask, that they can't gather. Rod Beck said that he himself attended an event with the mayor of Eagle where there were 750 people there, which is, I believe, breaking the distancing regulations in Ada County. And Ryan Davidson was, you know, saying hospitals are not overloaded, and we should not be, you know, in his words, sacrificing the economy in order to try and slow the spread of the virus. Whereas Democrats like Diana Lociondo and Bill Rutherford were much advocating for saying, hey, nobody likes restrictions, but they agreed that they should follow the advice of medical professionals and hospital, you know, organizers who have been pushing for these restrictions. Mm-hmm. Diana Lociondo has come under a lot of fire from Republicans for her votes on the Central District Health Board. I think her opponent, Ryan Davidson, had dubbed her Lockdown Lociondo in one of his campaign videos. There's been, you know, a lot of ire towards her online for voting for those mask mandates, closing bars, you know, but last night she defended it and said, you know, when the hospital professionals came to us and said that they wanted action, we listened to them. And that's just not what the Republicans were wanting to do. They were hoping for a much more open type of situation.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's fair to note that, last night, Davidson said on the record that people should wear masks and social distance. He doesn't want it a mandate, but he says people should do that. However, he went to a meet and greet last Friday that was put on by the Ada County Republicans, where no one was wearing masks, no one was social distancing, and there were more than 50 people, which goes against violates the stage that Ada County is in, which is stage 3, and that we are supposed to not have gatherings of more than 50 people. And you can hear him say that, right? You can find the forum on YouTube. And also that Davidson and Rodbeck both spoke at a people's rights potluck in Meridian's Kleiner Park. You can find the video on YouTube as well, folks. And the Southern Poverty Law Center has identified that group, People's Rights, as a hate group. So as we're moving forward, these elections may seem to go unnoticed, as you mentioned, Margaret, because of the bigger presidential races, but these local races make a big impact as well. So Mike, continuing with elections, let's talk about a story that you guys recently did, which is about Idaho college students who are from out of state, and them voting in the election.
Right. College students voting in elections it can be a really tense issue for both those voters as well as the rest of the outlying community. Sometimes they're discouraged from voting because they are viewed as part-time residents. But the important thing to know is, yes, they can vote as long as they've lived here for 30 days or more and they have proof of a residence in the state of Idaho. They are legally allowed to vote, with the obvious caveat, and I think it's really important to make it clear, you cannot vote in another state. If you came from another jurisdiction and you voted there, or you're voting absentee there, or you're planning to vote in person there, you obviously cannot vote in the local elections. But otherwise, if you live in Boise, if you live in the Treasure Valley, maybe you're a TVCC student, College of Western Idaho student, whatever it may be, you are allowed to vote.
Harrison, a really, really compelling article recently in the Boise Weekly. For those of us who vividly remember the story of flight attendant Lynn Henneman, it truly feels like yesterday. I remember covering this just unbelievable story. But here's the thing. We just passed the 20th anniversary of her murder, and your staff decided to really go into length about this and calling it the last flight of Lynn Henneman. Can you talk to us about this for people that may not be familiar with this 20-year-old case, but also why the decision to go down that path?
Well, yeah, I think those are excellent starting points for a story like this. It begins with the story of the story itself. John Barry, the author, is a well-known writer about town, and he approached me and talked to me about an experience that he had had when he was experiencing homelessness himself, that he had shared a room with the man who would ultimately be convicted of Lynn Henneman's death. He eventually elected to reach out to her killer. And that spurred him ultimately to this story, which is retracing her final steps, the last hours of her life. She was a flight attendant who came through Boise. She decided to go for a run on the Greenbelt, and she was raped and murdered on the Greenbelt. And it was absolutely horrifying. I've heard from a lot of people that they remember, Boise at that time, the way that it made people feel about the safety of their community. And it's one of those experiences that sticks out to people. It's an incredible story. It's brilliantly told. And we found it to be incredibly timely. Obviously, over the month of September, we've been able to publish it, this piece, in two parts. It's absolutely exquisite, but it's also an incredibly difficult piece of journalism because it does tackle something that's so sensitive to the community. It's so sensitive to the topics of homelessness and violence against women, and the general feeling of safety that people have, especially in places that might not be super well lit. Like, we think of the Greenbelt as this extremely safe place, and then there's just kind of this other side to it. And obviously, we don't want to portray Boise as this incredibly unsafe place, but it has these moments where that's kind of called into question. And we really felt as though this was a good time to talk about kind of the vibe of Boise in a way that you just won't, see or hear anyplace else.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I remember covering this, as I mentioned, and I'll tell you, as a single woman in my 20s at the time, you know, I stopped going on the Greenbelt when this happened. And it was not patrolled well before the killing of Lynn Henneman. And we should note that she was not the first woman killed on the Greenbelt. There had been another case a year or two before hers. And then there was the Samantha Maher. And then she was taken from near the Greenbelt in Julian Davis Park. There was a time in Boise, if you did not live here then, or you were too young to remember, that as single young women, the last place you wanted to be was on the Greenbelt.
Oh, absolutely. Boise has come a long, long way, but there are, I mean, even to this day, there are sections of the Greenbelt that, that's, you know, simply, you know, aren't very well lit. They're far away from where other people might be. And it wouldn't shock me at all if there are lots of women to this day who, you know, will not travel those stretches of the Greenbelt after dark.
Oh, yeah, I'm one of them still to this day. I mean, that I think that is the ripple effect of going back and doing this type of journalism, right? And understanding why there are women who feel that about the use of journalism here. I want to move on to a project along Boise Avenue. Can you talk to us about the project, but then what happened in regards to Mayor McLean, Boise Mayor McLean, having to cast a final vote on this?
Yeah, so this Tuesday night was the latest installment in a months-long saga of a project that was proposed on Boise Avenue for over 300 units of housing for upscale dormitory style living. And when I say upscale, I mean this private off-campus student development would have a pool and a fitness room and a coffee shop, you know, things like that. You know, far cry from the Towers dorm over there on Boise State campus. And neighbors have been fighting this development tooth and nail since it was proposed in November for two reasons. Folks that live in the area did not want the extra disruption of more students, the high density use, the traffic, the noise, but also it was going to displace an aging 32 unit apartment complex that is very low priced. And so back in February, before the pandemic hit, we were in city council chambers till 2 a.m. for a P&Z hearing where residents who live in that apartment complex were strongly opposed to the project and other neighbors spoke out against it. So we had the city council hearing finally on the project this Tuesday night, and it came down to a tie. City council member Patrick Bajant and city council pro tem Holly Woodings voted for the project because they said that it would provide student housing. It was dense, it was close to campus, walkable, it had enough parking to support large numbers of residents there, but they also understood the challenges. And then City Council Member Jimmy Halliburton and City Council President Elaine Clegg voted against it, saying that it just did not meet the standard of mixed use development, where because it didn't have a mix of commercial and residential uses for that corner, which is kind of supposed to be considered, you know, a mixed use resident, you know, residential and business area. And they just said having a ton of students there without businesses just doesn't meet that goal. And so that left Mayor McLean to cast the vote, because the other two council members, you know, Lisa Sanchez and City Council Member Thompson, or City Council Member Sanchez and City Council Member Thompson, were not there. And so McLean ended up siding with the folks who did not support the development. You know, she said, I'm not saying I don't support a development here, I'm not saying I don't support density, but she said it just didn't have enough mixed use. And she wanted to see something, in her words, you know, that were more beneficial for the greater community instead of just the very narrow population of students that would live in the building. And, you know, so now we will see if the developer will pitch the project again, or it will get developed in another way, because that is a very highly sought after corner.
Mike, I want to get back to the election, before I wrap things up today. And let's start with talking about absentee ballot signatures. This might not seem like a big deal, but it really is. And you've done some reporting on this because it can actually affect whether or not your vote gets counted, correct?
Exactly. Yeah. If the people who are checking ballots decide that your signature does not match a signature they have on file, they can discard that ballot. And so we spoke with Ada County Clerk Phil McRain. He gave us some tips. He did try to alleviate some of the concerns, saying number one, they say the biggest concern is people not signing their ballot at all. By far the majority of the reason why ballots are discarded is people forget to sign it. People forget to put it in the privacy envelope and things like that. So abiding by the rules that are on the ballot, I just received my ballot today. It comes with a how-to, specific instructions of each step you need to go through to make sure your ballot is counted. But signing it is the first thing. The other thing is they're looking to validate the voter. So they want to make sure, you know, if you're going to prevent voter fraud, you want to make sure that the right person is the person who's voting. So what signature do you have on file? It could be your driver's license. It could be other documents that you have within the state or city government. So it's something to consider to make sure that you are signing it in a way that matches. And you think about, some people may not have a signature on ballot since they were 18 years old. Right, I mean, right. I know I'm growing farther and farther away from being 18 years old, but I'm not that far away. And I have no idea how I signed anything when I was 18 years old. And I doubt anything I do now matches it. So that is definitely a consideration people are going to want to go through.
And then, Mike, you mentioned you got your ballot today. Ada County has started mailing those ballots out. So how do folks check their ballot status? Like, I'm still waiting for mine, for example.
Right. So you can go on to idahovotes.gov. And one of the options on idahovotes.gov is that you can check your voter record. You're going to need to put in your social security number, your birth date. It may not be social. I think it's birth date and your full name and your address. And I did that, put in whatever information. You can track the ballot. It tells you when you requested your ballot. For the longest time, it just had that date for me. And then it shifted immediately on the day they mailed the ballot. It said that it had been mailed. It says now that it's been mailed. When they receive it, they will note in the system that it has been received. So you can go in and just check, which I'm going to do, to make sure that the ballot gets where it's supposed to be and gets counted on election day.
And give that that website again, Mike, where folks can do
that. Yeah, it's idahovotes.gov.
Okay. I want to thank all of you for coming in today. I know it was a quick reporter roundtable because we really needed to talk about the positive diagnosis of COVID for President Trump. So thank you, all of you, for being really flexible today as well. Just so appreciate you guys and all of the reporting that you do. Mark Carmel, reporter with BoiseDev.com, Harrison Berry, managing editor with the Boise Weekly, and Mike Sharp, executive producer with Idaho News 6. Appreciate you guys so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
More Idaho Matters next.